This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Pat Curry. We're again in Lubbock, Texas, in the interview room in the Vietnam Archive. On the campus of Texas Tech, and it's August 4th, 2005, and it's about 9:15 a.m. Central Standard Time. And Pat, we ended our last session with talking a little bit about the rest of your career and where you went with your Army career up to 1991 when you retired as a lieutenant colonel. I'd like to back up and have you discuss a little more detail when you came home and went to college, that you're kind of entering into this atmosphere where the war is winding down, Vietnamization's going on, we are withdrawing troops from South Vietnam. Everybody knows the war is ending. We're not sure at this point in 1972 how it's going to end, what's going to happen, but we do know that it's happening. And in January or the spring of 1973, we signed the Paris Peace Accords, and we're done. So tell me what the atmosphere was like for you personally when you came back and you got back into school. What was it like on campus? You're still in, but I assume you dressed as a civilian. And did people know you were in the Army? Did you tell them you were in Vietnam? What happened in the classrooms? What was that atmosphere like?
Well, there was not a lot of, at least on our campus, there was not a lot of anti-war activity, not a lot of war-related activity either way. Mm-hmm. By 72, it had wound down somewhat, at least where I went to school, at Cal State Long Beach. At that time, you didn't hide it, but you didn't advertise the fact that you were in the Army either. Mm-hmm. You didn't, wear a name tag that said, "I'm in the Army."
Did you have your hair cut short still?
No, I got it grow out a little bit.
Okay.
It was like being a civilian. Like I think I mentioned before, the only contact I had with the Army was to draw my paycheck and send in my request for reimbursement. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't the only one there. There were several other Army guys going to school there as well.
How did you identify them?
One of them I met on a beach in Ensenada. Mm-hmm. We had gone down to Ensenada during a break at school. Had gone down to Ensenada for a vacation and got to talking to this other couple who were down there camping like we were. Found out he was also in the military. Hmm. He was an aviator.
Had he been in Vietnam?
Yes, he had. But we didn't talk about it at all. And we just talked about school and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we did talk about it. We were a little older than the average student. In a lot older in terms of experiences and places we've been, things we've done, that kind of stuff. So in terms of a lot of interface with the average 19-year-old student, no, I just wasn't. We just had nothing in common.
Right.
I mean, absolutely nothing in common. So there wasn't a lot of communication.
Right.
And
what about talk about Vietnam? If you didn't advertise you're in the Army, I can assume you probably didn't advertise you had been in Vietnam.
No, if it didn't come up, I didn't bring it up. Actually, I didn't hide it,
right?
But I didn't bring it up either. It just wasn't. I mean, you got to figure this is a time when guys working at the Pentagon were told to wear civilian clothes to and from work so they maintain a low profile.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't something that you spread around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't come up a lot, frankly.
Yeah. What about in the classroom? What kind of courses were you taking? And did social science, history, Vietnam, any of that stuff, current affairs, did it come up in class? And what did you do?
Most of my courses, of course, were business courses.
Yes.
That was my major. I took probably the most interesting course I took was Europe, history of Europe since 1914, and had an excellent professor. He was really good, and he didn't look at history in terms of a series of political events. He looked at the whole context. He played the three-penny opera in class and the whole works. And I was really kind of hoping we'd get up to, at that time, current events, but right. we never did make it quite that far. We kind of got to about 1935 or so, and then then the semester ended.
Okay.
But
so it didn't really come up so much in the classroom?
Not really. I don't remember it coming up very much at all.
Okay.
Really don't. It just wasn't on the campus. It just wasn't a big hot topic. It was obvious everything was winding down. It was obvious we were pulling out. There were a lot of somewhat older students at this school, and they were a little more focused on school than they were on politics and that kind of thing. And so it just didn't come up an awful lot.
Well, what did you think about, at the time, the whole Nixon-Kissinger, public image, the negotiating going on, peace with honor, statements, going 72 and into 73, what were your feelings?
Well, it was, I think, intuitively obvious to the casual observer that what we were trying to do was get our butts out of Vietnam as quickly as humanly possible with the minimum amount of embarrassment that we could. But clearly the priority was getting out. Mm-hmm. And I think the political posturing that was going on about peace with honor and that kind of thing was just that. Nixon didn't want to just cut and run, but clearly he was getting out. And so I think the peace with honor thing was just rhetoric. I never met anybody that really thought Vietnamization was going to work. Bear in mind, I didn't, have coffee with generals every day.
Sure.
But, among the guys that I knew, I never knew anybody that thought that was going to work.
Did you guys talk about it?
Yeah.
The people within your circle?
Yeah, we did. And the military guys that I knew, before I went to school and I was at the advanced course and afterwards. And I, like I say, I don't know of anybody that ever thought that was going to work. Mm-hmm. The desire to fight just wasn't there.
What did you think at the time? Did you think it was a good idea for us to leave? Or did you think that we needed to do something different and stay?
Well, I thought that we needed to do something different and stay. But I also didn't think that we could stay given the environment in the United States. It was obvious to me, or it appeared to me, I guess I should say, that there was just no way that the pressure to leave was going to get out, or I'm sorry, the pressure to leave was going to decrease, that it was only going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
That I mentioned before, it had become a very popular, a very trendy thing to oppose the war. There was more and more of that going on. Mm-hmm. I did not think it was the right thing to do, but clearly it was going to happen.
Right. What do you think the United States, this is, again, a counterfactual question, but at the time, what did you think that the United States should be doing versus withdrawing? Do you remember having thoughts like, we really need to step up the air raids. We need to take troops from this region and put them here.
Yeah, and bearing in mind that I was pretty unsophisticated. I still am, but even more so at that time. The obvious answer was step up the bombing raids, go into Cambodia, expand the kinds of things that Nixon was doing, mm-hmm. to take the war to the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the major problems with Vietnam was we, in essence, sat there in South Vietnam and waited for the enemy to come to us.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot win a war that way. A defensive war cannot be won, and I think that history shows that the kinds of things that Nixon did in terms of going into Cambodia and wiping out the huge depots that were there, the bombing campaigns in North Vietnam, those kinds of things had an effect,
mm-hmm.
and they had a very strong negative effect on the NVA. I mean, we destroyed a lot of their logistics tail. and inevitably that has an effect. Even when you could live on a handful of rice a day, like, you know, the old cliche about those guys, mm-hmm. if you don't have that handful of rice, and if you don't have bullets, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Why do we wait so long, do you think?
I think the political aspects of it, just the idea of going into a sovereign nation that technically was not involved in the war, theoretically was not involved, and well, clearly was, mm-hmm. but and that was a source of great frustration to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, this imaginary line on the ground, they could cross it at will, we couldn't.
Right.
But, yeah, if we seriously wanted to win that war, we needed to do those kinds of things. I think that the question was China. There were, I believe, Chinese and North Korea's advisors and that kind of thing. Periodically, we would find evidence of Soviet and Chinese advisors in South Vietnam.
You mean in North Vietnam? You said North Korea?
I'm sorry, North Vietnam, mm-hmm. yes. I'm sorry. Think about my dad.
Yes.
periodically, we'd find evidence of Soviet and Chinese advisors in South Vietnam where they'd been accompanying NVA mm-hmm. And that kind of thing. So, you know, we... MacArthur significantly miscalculated in Korea, and I think that people were being extraordinarily cautious about that in Vietnam. The other side is that there was a military contingent that wanted to use nuclear weapons.
Yes.
And I think that was horrendous. That just was not acceptable. To me, not to anybody
at the time.
At the time, ever since, and now, I think those guys were nuts wanting to use nuclear weapons in a place like Vietnam. I mean, as important as I believe Vietnam was, the short-term survival of the United States was not at risk. I mean, the North Vietnamese were not going to invade Long Beach.
Right.
And there was just absolutely no justification for using nuclear weapons. We did not want to open that box. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, I think all those guys should have been retired immediately. But I have pretty strong feelings on that.
Yes.
I've already said I think using the nuclear weapons in Japan in World War II was fully justified and certainly the way to go. You know, as a guy who probably wouldn't be here if they hadn't done that, I obviously have strong feelings. Mm-hmm. My brother and I talked about that when he came up to visit. He feels more strongly than I do.
Oh, yeah.
He's about 3 years younger. He certainly wouldn't have been here. But anyway, I get pretty rabid when they start talking about using nuclear weapons in Vietnam.
So nuclear weapons, according to what you're saying, should be used when our national survival is literally at stake.
Yes.
And in Vietnam...
It clearly was not. I think our long-term... Well, at that time, mm-hmm. I mean, who knew what was going to happen to the Soviet Union?
Sure.
Nobody knew that. I mean, they seemed like this huge monolithic block mm-hmm. that was just going to be around forever. Obviously wrong answer, but anyway, right. That's what it seemed like at the time.
Well, they almost had, policymakers almost had to assume that.
Yes. And, you know, with thousands of nuclear warheads on both sides and that kind of thing, you had to be mm-hmm. reasonably careful about that. Mm-hmm. But, and we certainly didn't want to, like I said, open that box in Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
Tell me what your reaction was to seeing Vietnam veterans protest against the war, the Vietnam veterans against the war, the VBAW, folks like that who were, you know, right there in the National Mall in Washington, D.C., throwing their medals on the Capitol steps and at the White House.
I was of two minds about that. One was they had every constitutional right to do that. That's freedom of speech. That's why we have an army, and they absolutely had the right to do that. Mm-hmm. The other side was, boy, it really pissed me off. I mean, they were degrading and denigrating the thing that I had chosen to
to spend my life doing. And although I probably didn't even know that at the time, but I was still in the military, and it really upset me considerably.
So you thought they were not only insulting you all of that generation personally, they were kind of insulting the military establishment?
The military, the Army as a whole. And, you know, to a lot of us who were in Vietnam, those medals meant something. Mm-hmm. And to a lot of us, they still did. I think I mentioned I'm not, by any stretch of the imagination, a Kerry fan. And that puts it rather mildly, but boy, it made me mad when they started insulting the Silver Star. To me, based on my experience, if you got a Silver Star, you earned it. Mm-hmm. You did not get that for some little minor picky thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying it never happened, but I'm saying I never saw it happen, mm-hmm. that somebody got a Silver Star for political reasons or something like that.
Right. Right.
And it made me mad when they started that kind of crap about his Silver Star.
There were veterans who threw their Silver Stars back.
Yeah, I don't understand that. Maybe that's the best way to put it. I just don't understand it. They were recognized for something heroic that they did, something very courageous and brave that they did. And to me, that should have meant something to them. Mm-hmm. And maybe it did, and maybe that's why they threw the medal, is because they were giving up something that was important to them to make a statement. Mm-hmm. And so
you can see that side of it.
I can see that side of it, but I sure disagree with it. I don't think it was a right thing to do.
Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you about some of the big events that happened there in the early 70s, and just kind of get your reaction. Based on just coming out of the war and the war still going on and the United States pulling out and watching the war continue. Tell me first about Kent State. How did you react to that? I mean, that's 70 and then 71, 72, 73. You know, it's got the fallout for a couple of years there. And today, even when you mention that university's name, people, one of the first things they think about is that incident. Of anti-war protesters.
Certainly what I think about it. And it took me years to understand that. You know, you mentioned reflecting back on things and thinking about things, and that's one of the things that I've reflected back on and thought about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Why? I mean, maybe the answer's obvious, but tell me why that you have thought so much about that.
You know, it was such a huge event. We killed our own citizens. And I didn't agree with what they were doing, and I thought they were doing the wrong thing. But, you know, it wasn't a capital punishment kind of crime.
Right.
It was clearly a panic/training issue with the National Guard guys that were there. And it clearly should never have happened. At the time, when it happened, I was mostly just confused.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand truly what had happened, and I certainly didn't understand why it had happened. And it took me years to kind of sort through that. And it was a group of people that said, well, you know, they got what they deserved. And, I mean, my God, no 19-year-old deserves to get killed for expressing their opinion, even if they were running rampant and running around on campus and still an 18 or 19 year old and it shouldn't have happened.
It wasn't one person, it was four people.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, you had direct involvement with the National Guard right there in 1974. Mm-hmm. What did you see as the state of the National Guard?
Well,
because they're the ones who were on the campus that day.
It was in sad shape. And the National Guard officers, senior NCOs, have been around a while, would tell you that. They were in bad shape.
What way?
Very low motivation, not trained at all. Mm-hmm. There'd been a tremendous turnover, mm-hmm. been a tremendous influx of people who didn't want to go to Vietnam. And low morale. Mm-hmm. And uh, just
very difficult to kind of try to pull that together. For the leadership to kind of resolve those kinds of problems, those kinds of issues. You know, anti-war guys would go into the National Guard so that they didn't have to go to Vietnam. Well, they weren't going to get in there and work hard for the National Guard and make that a better place.
Right.
And they didn't. And don't get me wrong, there were some very good, very dedicated people there, mm-hmm. but I think they were the minority, and I think they were pretty frustrated. A lot of them got out just out of sheer frustration. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember talking to one major in the Illinois National Guard, good guy, real sharp guy, and he was pretty upset, and he was talking about when they'd had the riots in Chicago when Martin Luther King was assassinated. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, we were good. He said, we were sharp. We were disciplined. We knew what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, we've just gone to hell. And so he was pretty upset about
that's
it.
That's what, 6 years later?
Six years. It just went down that fast, like the rest of the Army.
Yeah.
You know, it just crashed that fast.
Was that because of Vietnam and what had happened, or was it because of the leadership within the Army and Vietnam? And why do you think that happened so quickly?
Well, you know, the Army is a reflection of society at large in many ways it's kind of a little insulated society, but in many ways it's a reflection of society at large. And with everything that went on in the 60s, mm-hmm. you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and the anti-war movement, and I mean, those were the kinds of things that were happening, and those kinds of things inevitably affected the Army. A lot of the old values had not broken down; they had vanished.
Mm-hmm.
He's my longest, oldest friend. We've been friends for almost 40 years, and actually for 40 years. And he came from a very stable middle class family. His father had been a MD and an Air Force colonel.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been very much upper middle class. He just dropped out completely.
Dropped out of
society. I mean, you know, remember the old cliche, tune in, turn on, and drop out?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did that.
So he was of that mindset.
He wasn't a real hippie, but boy, he was pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't living on the streets, but pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring him up because, you know, he's such a symbol of the times that, you know, things were changing. You would have expected Jay to have this fairly ordinary middle class kind of life, you know, three bedroom, two bath in the suburbs and that kind of thing. And here he just went way, way out. And I mean, you talk about two opposite ends of the spectrum, but we stayed friends.
You did continue.
We did, absolutely. We were always friends, you know. And we each respected what the other was doing, and we were friends first, and all the other stuff came later.
Right.
And despite the fact that he's probably as far left as I am right, neither one of us are at the way far out ends of the spectrum. I mean, just we're a lot closer to the center than that, but
sure.
We're probably equal distances from the center, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
And we're still good friends. And I just talked to him on the phone the other day, in fact. But
did you meet him?
In college. We were fraternity brothers.
Okay.
The first time around.
Okay.
He's probably the reason I didn't graduate. But
I'm sure he'll appreciate that.
Not true. He'd probably take credit for it. But
yeah.
Anyway, I bring him up because he's such a symbol of what happened with things changing so fast. You know, if you didn't live through that time, and I was pretty well insulated in the military. I lived on base and that kind of thing.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, VW buses all over the place. Just full of kids who had left home and gone.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and it just, the old values vanished so quickly, and were replaced with kind of a vacuum. And in Vietnam, very much of a moral vacuum. And, you know, that's when we started talking about situational ethics and mm-hmm. those kinds of things. And so there was just nothing to fill that vacuum. And structures crumbled without anything to replace them. And in many ways, it was just chaos. I mean, when you saw bankers wearing flowered shirts, I mean, you know, you just had to figure things were weird.
Yeah.
And things were weird, too.
Yeah.
Did that make any sense?
Absolutely.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. It was a strange, strange time.
And I think that's what you're conveying, that things kind of got flipped upside down for a while. You know, with what was happening in Vietnam, we were faced with our top officials saying, we have achieved peace with honor. South Vietnam is an independent state. We have achieved these goals, and we are able to bring our boys home. And you're saying you saw that as rhetoric. Do you still think?
Oh, yeah. I don't know of anybody that believed that.
Okay.
And regardless of whether they were right or left, I don't know of anybody that believes that. I think it was just very cynical politics.
What do you think of Kissinger?
Well, he's a brilliant guy. Just a brilliant guy. And a little too, perhaps, a little too pragmatic.
Mm-hmm.
A little too willing to do whatever was necessary to achieve his goals.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly a brilliant man.
What did you think about the United States leaving in 1973? I mean, we're out. There are no ground troops there. There's some unofficial folks still hanging out assisting the locals. But I mean, we're essentially out of the war. Did you feel a sense of relief? Did you feel like, boy, we didn't do this well? What were your feelings there in 1973?
Very much we didn't do this well. Very much we lost the war. And
why did you think that?
Well, I mean, let's face it. We tucked our tail between our legs and hoofed it on out of there. We didn't achieve peace with honor. We didn't even achieve peace. We were not fighting, but boy, the South Vietnamese that had depended on us sure were. I was upset. I just did not think it was the right thing to do. I didn't think it was the right thing to do ethically and morally. I didn't think it was the right thing to do politically.
Mm-hmm.
In every aspect that you can think of, I thought it was wrong.
What about your feelings in April 1975? You know, 18 months later, you've got the fall of the entire country.
Yeah, I was heartbroken.
Did you watch it on TV?
Yeah, I did. And it was very, very difficult for me to watch. I was just heartbroken. I thought we'd already lost the war. And I was not surprised that South Vietnam collapsed. I was a little surprised it happened that fast.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, I probably shouldn't have been surprised, but God, I was just heartbroken. That picture of that helicopter is just etched in my mind. Of course, it's been replayed so many times since then. Movies and everything else, but if you've seen Miss Saigon, I was heartbroken.
What did Diana think? Do you remember talking to her about it?
No, I really don't. And incidentally, she's going to call you to schedule an appointment. We talked about it last night. She filled out her forms and all that. I don't think she was quite as emotionally involved in it as I was.
Did you tell her how you were feeling? Did you say, I'm heartbroken, I just can't believe this, I feel this, and this?
Yeah, I really don't remember, but I probably did.
Okay. You weren't keeping all that inside?
No, I don't keep much inside. Pretty much if I feel it, I say it, but to this day, I just think we gave them such a bad deal, and we didn't even try, you know. I mean, when it was obvious what was going to happen, we didn't even try to get our friends out. We just, I guess it's real politics, but we just abandon them. And you know, that's not our country's values. We're supposed to stand by our friends, And the leadership might not have been the best guys in the world, but, you know, there were a lot of guys at lower levels that were our friends and that staked their whole future on us and their family's futures on us and wound up as boat people or worse in the camps and that kind of thing.
When you see Vietnamese today, do you think about that?
Yeah.
Here in the United States?
Yeah. Yeah, but mostly what I think about is, my God, look what they've done. You know, I mean, if you go, we've got relatives in the L.A. area, if you go out there and the honor graduates are valedictorians and salutatorians are always Vietnamese names. They just work so hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let me ask about another subject that occurred and was very much in the public eye 1970 going forward was the My Lai massacre. And that, first, what was your reaction to hearing about this as someone in the U.S. Army? And then also, this is attached to Vietnam. It's one of these incidents where when people think of the war, if they listed 10 or 15 things, knowledgeable people think about the war, they might say, you know, My Lai. Tell me what your feelings are about My Lai as an Army officer, and then in general about its attachment to Vietnam.
At the time, I didn't believe it. I just said no. In fact, Jay Gamble, my friend that I mentioned, uh-huh. His mom, Jane, was a real sweetheart, and I was kind of like a second son to her. Mm-hmm. And she asked me about it, and I said, no, it didn't happen. I don't believe it. And when it started coming out that obviously it had happened, mm-hmm. and that obviously some very senior people had tried to cover it up, mm-hmm. I mean, I was alternately disgusted to the point of being nauseated and furious. And that an Army officer would do something like that. You know, what happened to duty, honor, country? You know? We're Army officers. We're not supposed to do that kind of thing. And we're sure as hell not supposed to cover it up.
And this is the person who was the one who shouldered the majority of the blame was a lieutenant, mm-hmm. same rank as you when
yep.
you were over there.
Yep. And he deserved 100 times what he got.
He was eventually pardoned and set free.
Yeah, and he should have been, I won't say he should have been shot, but he certainly should have gone to Leavenworth for the rest of his life, as should Medina. And I mean, these guys were no better than common murderers walking out on the street here. And it just, to this day, I guess I better calm down, to this day it just makes me furious. And the general lost one star and that kind of thing, and it's just, it's obscene. And then Medina gets this big high-paying job from some right-wing nut. And I mean, these guys were murderers. They disgraced their nation. They disgraced their army. And they were rewarded for it. And that's what was crazy about the time. I mentioned that things were just so upside down. Mm-hmm. You know, I supported the army. I supported the war effort. I did not and do not support mass murder.
Of course.
And I just, you know, I wasn't a grunt, and maybe I just can't understand the mindset. Callie's mindset, Medina's mindset, I mean, they were out there facing it every day. But, you know, the brigade commander and the division commander, those guys have covered it up, you know? I can never understand that. Mm-hmm.
To play devil's advocate for a moment, don't atrocities happen in every war?
They do, and they're not justified in any war. You know, they certainly happened in Korea. They certainly happened in World War II. I mean, watch Band of Brothers. You know, they had some fairly frank incidents in there, but that doesn't make it right in any war.
It's no less wrong in Vietnam than it was in World War II. Mm-hmm.
Cal is still alive and well in Georgia right now as we mm-hmm. speak in 2005. What would you say to him?
I'd say you're scum. That's exactly what I would say.
That's from one Army officer to a former.
From one Army officer to a former Army officer, you're scum. And you got away with something you shouldn't have got away with. I mean, how do you ever justify automatic weapons fire on a ditch full of women and children? I mean, these weren't combatants. Mm-hmm. You know, these were terrified human beings. Mm-hmm. And you just can't ever... I don't care what you say about combat fatigue and that kind of thing. You just can't ever justify that.
How do you think, then, on the heels of that conversation, of that exchange with us, tell me about the role the media played in the war. Going back, you know, kind of before you were there, what did you see and hear? And then, obviously, we know that the media played a larger and larger role, especially Tet Offensive and post-Tet. And with the war in Iraq, we had reporters right there on the front lines, the embedded reporters, different policy that the people who were orchestrating this said was a direct reflection of what went wrong in Vietnam. That media coverage was uncontrolled to an extent. And this one was going to be, you know, allow them to see it, but you also can control that because they're right there with you. And so tell me, overall, media coverage of the Vietnam War and what role that played for you personally and for the country.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry I got so emotional about me. It's a very emotional subject with me, even now.
Well, Pat, you're not alone in that.
I feel sure, and one of these days I'll find out how most other people feel about it. But and the other side of it was on a little more calculating or cold side was it certainly gave the anti-war forces a tool, a lever, another lever. You know, there were some real pivotal events, Tet being one of them. The picture of the little girl who'd been burned by napalm, another one. And Mimai, another one.
Mimai's on the cover of Time Magazine, or Life Magazine.
Yeah. And the media, I think, did the right thing there on Mimai in exposing it. Clearly the Army wasn't going to. But anyway, as far as media coverage goes, you know, the reason we lost Tet, we won Tet, the big Tet, we won the big Tet militarily. It was a huge defeat for the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese. The North Vietnamese could not compete with us in set piece battles. They didn't have the weapons, they didn't have the numbers. They just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can sit up and puff and blow machine gun fire and 105 artillery fire down on them forever, and they can't even hope to reach the gun platform. Mm-hmm. But thanks to the media coverage, we certainly lost Tet politically.
What do you mean by that?
The media looked past the military side of it, and I think put their own interpretation on it. They chose to say the fact that the North Vietnamese could mount such an offensive, mm-hmm. just the fact they could mount such an offensive was a major defeat. To this day, I don't understand that perspective. It's a war. Any sensible armed force is going to try to get on the offensive. I mean, that's how you win a war. You go on the offensive. And clearly that's what they were trying to do. Smart little beggars realized that even if they were beat militarily, they were going to win politically, and they were right.
thanks to the media coverage. Another pivotal event was the picture of the Vietnamese policeman executing with the pistol the NVA guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the right wing tried to justify that by saying, well, the guy who was killed had just killed half a dozen of these guys. Well, you know, we're supposed to be above that.
Right.
Rule of law, that kind of thing. But anyway, I think the media chose to cover it as a defeat, made a conscious decision to do that, and did so, and succeeded in changing the political perspective on the war. The mainstream perspective on the war to one that was negative, and to one that Tet was a major defeat when in fact it was not.
Right there, it's pivotal time in 1968. I kind of see you taking that as the media coverage was there before, but it really shifted things post Tet or during Tet and post Tet. And then Johnson said in 1968. Or shortly thereafter, talking about Walter Cronkite's statements on television, the leading newsman, news person of the day, he said, if I've lost Cronkite, I have lost the average American citizen. And that's paraphrasing him. But what did you think of Cronkite's statements and kind of that idea that he had some newsman is saying that on national television?
Well, I thought it was wrong of Cronkite to do that. You know, the news, at least the news media, at least pretends to be unbiased. You know, my brother, I mentioned, was visiting a couple weeks ago, and he asked me why I was watching Fox. And he's a Kerry guy, I'm a Bush guy, you know, so it gets interesting. But he asked me why I was watching Fox. And I said, well, you know, I watch Fox half the time, I watch CNN half the time, so I come out somewhere in the middle. And I think that's a true statement. You know, I think it was wrong of Cronkite to do that. The news is supposed to be unbiased.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to present events and facts. And if it's interpretation, they're supposed to say that so that people will know they're hearing opinions, not facts. They pretend to be unbiased. I don't think they are. And Jay Gamble, incidentally, my friend, works in the media. We don't discuss this. I do. I think it was wrong of Cronkite to say that, but I agree with what Johnson said, that clearly showed he'd lost the mainstream and that the silent majority wasn't there anymore,
mm-hmm.
or at least was dwindling rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was an accurate observation.
Do you think that Vietnam being the first TV war, that here's the war, you can watch it on the evening news as you eat, you know, supper with your family, what kind of effect does that have on a country? What did you see then?
Well, I think it had a real major effect. I think that seeing what happens is bound to make anyone think about it twice.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly if you are uncertain, it's gonna affect you. It's got to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, seeing those kinds of things happen. And I don't think it was so much the fact that the coverage was there. And I don't mean to sound like a right-wing nut here ranting on about the media, but I think, you know, when the most respected newsman in America comes on and starts and makes a blatantly anti-war statement, you know, you just have to look at whether the media as a whole is biased or not. And I think they were, and I think it was not so much the fact of the coverage as it was the way the coverage was kind of skewed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, focusing as they're doing now in Iraq totally on the casualties, the setbacks, those kinds of things is bound to skew public opinion.
I mean, if that's all you hear day after day, week after week, month after month, no matter how strong your feelings are, you're going to start to wonder. Mm-hmm. And I think people did start to wonder, and I think they're starting to wonder now. And all we hear out of Iraq, not all, that's not a true statement, but certainly the majority of what we hear out of Iraq right now is, we had X number of casualties today, there were X number of bombs, Y number of Iraqis were killed, the minister was killed, etc. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know guys over there, and we're doing a lot of stuff over there. You know, we're putting in sewer systems. They had big coverage, I guess a couple of months, 2-3 months ago, about this family that didn't have a sewer, and that out in front of their house was this cesspool of sewage and et cetera. And that plagued 2 or 3 days. Well, you know, you don't build the infrastructure of an entire country in a year. You know, and there was zero coverage of the water plants, the water purification plants, the electric. We heard a lot about when there wasn't electric.
Right.
When they got electric, we didn't hear anything. I guess I am sounding like a right wing nut here, but it really frustrates me. There's a lot of really good things going on over there, mm-hmm. and when we were getting the reports from the front lines, from the guys who really were embedded, we saw a lot of good things. The soldier singing that song from the back of a track with all the Iraqi kids down there, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of that kind of thing going on, and we just never hear about it. And it's very frustrating. There's no balance, I guess, is what
right.
I'm trying to
right.
say. They have an obligation to report the casualties and the bad things,
sure.
clearly. But I think they also have an equal obligation to report some of the good things, and they just don't do that. Afghanistan got essentially zero coverage. Okay, 1% coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Until they started having attacks again. All of a sudden, Afghanistan's in the news. You know, after months of hearing essentially nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's a big deal because there's attacks going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little frustrating.
What kind of exposure did you have in Vietnam to reporters and the media? Did they ever visit your
area? Well, I don't think I ever saw one.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think I ever saw one.
What was your attitude toward them at the time? Were you told, you know, here's how you need to treat the media if you ever come across them?
I don't know that it ever came up.
Okay.
Yes. I don't remember it.
Colonel Hawk never?
Yeah. They weren't going to visit a logistics unit.
Right.
You know, I mean, they were going to go see the grunts, which is as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
They were fighting a war. I don't remember seeing any in 1st or the 5th Cab either. One time, I wasn't there, but a couple of congressmen came out to visit LZ Dolly on top
right.
of Leon,
right.
and some reporters came with them. But that was the only time I even remember hearing about it.
Mm-hmm. If you don't mind, let me ask some personal questions
sure.
about your own reflections and your experience there and how you see yourself today, and you look back at Vietnam today. And this, again, might be kind of an obvious question, but how do you feel about your service in Vietnam? You were there a year, but what do you feel about it today?
I'm proud of it. I'm glad I did it. And I'm glad I did it for a couple of reasons. I think I mentioned before, I thought that us being in Vietnam was the right thing to do, which is different from saying we handled it well, but
right.
being there was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Communism was a threat to the United States,
mm-hmm.
and I was doing my little part in helping stop communism from spreading. And I thought that the South Vietnamese did not want to be taken over by the North Vietnamese. And it turns out I was right. I'm proud I was there. And I'm very pleased that it's something now that the country seems to realize that they treated the Vietnam vets poorly. And that and the country seems to be sorry for that. They seem to regret that.
What are the signs that lead you to that conclusion?
Well, the Desert Storm vets are being treated so much better. I mean, they're looked on as heroes and really treated well. And even my buddies in the media have said that, you know, the soldiers coming back from Vietnam were treated poorly and it shouldn't have happened. And,
so a legacy, you're saying, of the war is don't treat veterans like we did.
Exactly.
Treat them like you're doing now.
Differentiate between the vet who's doing his job, or the soldier who's doing his job, and the policymakers whose policies you may disagree with. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, they're two different things totally, and they deserve to be treated separately. Mm-hmm. And as a Vietnam vet, I am very much benefiting from what's happening because of Desert Storm and what's going on in Iraq. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been some major legislative changes lately that have really benefited me personally.
Yes.
And I'm very pleased to see that, and, mm-hmm. and very pleased that the current vets, Desert Storm and Iraq, are being treated so well, both by the nation as a whole and by the government. Mm-hmm. I think that's just fantastic.
You said earlier that you didn't receive any undue treatment when you came home personally, that you really haven't suffered from any kind of PTSD. Except for the few dreams or the incidents right when you came back. Do you suffer any other or any kind of disabilities from your service in Vietnam? And I know you went around the world with your Army service in general, but you don't have to comment on that
at all. That's fine. I have 50% disability. Some of it is just, you know, blood pressure and that kind of stuff, but mm-hmm. but the major portion of it is my back. Mm-hmm. I mentioned one time that we had a tactical emergency for the 11th Armored Cav.
Yes.
And we had everybody down there humping 80-pound boxes of 50 caliber ammunition.
Right.
And I screwed my back up that day and have paid for it ever since. Mm. And so that is the major portion of my disability is...
Okay.
It was not a wound, and I don't want anybody to think I'm trying to portray it as a wound. I just lifted something wrong
and
screwed up my back.
It's been with me ever since.
I remember clearly after I got back, I leaned over and picked up a phonograph record, an LP, and I could feel my back just side to side.
Mm.
It hurt, and it still hurts. But, you know, it's one of those things.
Yeah. Pat, is there anything that you would change about your Vietnam service? If you could go back and redo something, what would you do? If there's nothing you would change?
I can't think of anything really that I would change. I really kind of had... you know, you asked me about how I felt about going to Vietnam, and I was glad I went, and I'm glad I went to this day. You know, it was a truly unique experience. And it's one of those experiences that as an Army brat, as a soldier at the time, that I wanted to have, and I'm glad that I had it. And I am, as I mentioned several times, I'm thankful I had the kind of tour that I had. I actually got to see some of the war, the real war, instead of sitting back at Long Bend Depot or somewhere in Benoit for my entire 12 months and essentially having an 8-to-5 job.
Right, you said you weren't in the rear. But
I was in
the rear.
Yeah. And I got to spend some time on fire bases and see what that was like. And so I can't say that really there's anything about my tour that I would change.
Personally, how do you think your service there in Vietnam, and you've commented on this kind of extraneously throughout this whole process, but what do you think was the most significant thing that you took from your experience?
I really think that the most significant thing that I took from my experience in Vietnam was learning from Colonel Hawk how to be a leader. Mm-hmm. From watching him, seeing the kinds of things that he did with me, that he did with the soldiers, that he did with his other officers, and saying, well, that's how you become a leader. That's how you do that. And beyond that, to say that's how you become a good human being. And and I'm not going to say that Colonel Hawk didn't look after his career. You had to. But I don't think that he sacrificed his principles for the sake of his career like some others, some others may have done. And in terms of significant things that followed me for years and years, I think that was the most significant thing.
Okay.
And I guess the reverse of that is I saw some people that I learned, I don't want to do that. Right. And I sure don't want to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered those things too.
Okay.
And I think that follows me to this day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been in supervisory positions my whole life, and except for a couple of minor staff jobs, and I've been a supervisor since I retired. And I kind of do the same kinds of things now that I did in the military.
Except you can't write Article 15.
Except I can't do Article 15 now.
Well, this is a similar question, but how has the war most affected you? Is it through your leadership, your learning of the leadership skills, or is it something more personal within yourself, in your personal life?
You know, I really think it's a very personal thing. And I think being part of that and part of those times, it just affects you at the deepest levels. And you know, it's funny that the older I get, the more I think about it, the more deeply I think about it. And the more I think that I realize how much it has affected me. And the older I get, the more proud I become of what I did. I think maybe because I understand it a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's funny. You really tend to feel a sense of kinship, to use an old cliche, a sense of brotherhood with the other guys. You know, I was in the Dallas airport a little while ago, and there was a guy in there, and he had a Vietnam hat on. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and the conversation always starts out, "When were you there?" Always. And turns out we were there overlapping. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was just instant, just a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talked for a while, you know, about where we were and what we did and everything, what we're doing now, and what we were doing at the airport. And when we left, you know, we shook hands and kind of clenched, you know, and it was kind of an emotional moment, you know, and it wasn't just the war experience, but at the anti-war experience,
right,
as well, that kind of makes you bond like that. And it was just a real neat experience, just a real good experience, that kind of a connection with another guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it has a excuse me, has affected me on a real personal level, and it's just a tremendous relief to have that perception. You know, when for years after Vietnam, the bad guy in a TV show was always a Vietnam vet, always a druggie. Always a homeless guy, a criminal who couldn't get a job and hold a job, you know, that kind of thing. And if you look at Platoon and those movies like that, you know, that was the perception of Vietnam vets. And I've had people ask me, you know, did you have horrible times when you got back from Vietnam? And no, I didn't. And I'm just so glad that kind of perception seems to have gone away.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see the media now saying, you know, this Iraq vet, drug addict, homeless person robbed a bank.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I'm seeing this guy on the news last night that hoped to become the first Desert Storm vet to go to Congress. You know, good coverage of the veterans, as opposed to what we got after Vietnam.
When I talk to veterans over the years, I've heard this statement, and I'd like for you to reflect upon it, comment upon it, if you care to. Many of them say that their year in Vietnam was the most significant thing that's ever happened to them. More than the birth of their children, more than getting married, more than anything. And I'm sure that depends on personality, depends on their experience in country, what they did. But why do you think that's something that is said, and it's been said quite often?
It is not the most significant thing in my life, and it's not even close. Mm-hmm. It clearly was a significant thing in my life. Mm-hmm. But it is, you know, I mentioned it's hour after hour of boredom interspersed with moments of stark terror.
Right.
And those moments are so intense. And they touch you at such a deep level that it is a tremendously significant thing. And that's not unique to Vietnam. If you read the books about the vets who came back from World War II, many of them feel that way to this day. And I personally think it's a damn shame that a 20-year-old has already happened, had the most significant thing in his life that's ever going to happen. That's really unfortunate, because I don't think you should ever spend your whole life looking backwards. You clearly should look backwards, mm-hmm. But that should not be your whole life. And but you know, it can be, especially to the grunts. You know, not so much us guys who are ramps, but to the grunts, you know, it is so intense that it clearly changes you at such a basic level that I can see how people would feel that way.
You're talking about the fighting.
I'm talking about the fighting guys, the killing, the almost being killed, you know.
The nasty side.
Well, there's no good side to war. There just isn't. But you know, with the ultimate failure of politicians. But you know, that seeing, you know, even in my position in the rear, you know, seeing a body laying there just torn apart. Those kinds of things have to affect you at a very deep level, and it's not part of ordinary life in the United States, and it's bound to be significant. I don't agree that it's the most significant. Having my family was far more significant to me than my war experience. Having my daughters and Diana and having my grandkids. I mean, man, if I'd have known grandkids were this much fun, I'd have had them first. And my daughters don't even complain now anymore when I spoil the grandkids. They know it's not going to do any good. But those kinds of things are far more significant to me than my year in Vietnam was. It was a big part of my life. Vietnam was and is. Mm-hmm. And just as Korea was a big part of my dad's life until the day he died.
Sure.
But it certainly is not the most significant thing that, in my life. And I can tell you that I spend a lot more time thinking about my grandkids and my girls than I do about Vietnam.
Sure. Let's take a break for a minute.
Sure.
Okay, Pat. We took a bit of a break there, and you had mentioned something else about me, Lai. And I wanted to get you to repeat that and make some comments on one of the other legacies of me, Lai.
Well, Me Lai came about because some people wrote letters to their congressmen reporting what had happened. And obviously Congress took action on it, and there were a lot of consequences. But as a result of that, writing letters reporting your commander got to be a very trendy thing in the Army. And the investigative arm of the Army is the IG, the Inspector General. And they just got dozens of letters from congressmen, forwarded by congressmen from various people reporting their commander for reporting commanders for a variety of infractions, real and imagined. Mm-hmm. And so it got to be a time of being pretty careful about the things that you did.
What was the time frame here when this?
Oh, 69, 70, 71. I was investigated.
Were you really?
I really was. I had, you know, as a young officer, and at the time, I had faked some paperwork for an inspection, and it was really a fairly minor incident, but nevertheless, one of my Les Sterling guys wrote his congressman, who sent it to the IG, and they came down and interviewed me for several hours and everything, and the CG called me to his office, and I really thought it was absolutely the end of my career. I just was making plans to get out and go home and find a job and do those kinds of things, and the CG, General Ostrom, Brigadier General, called me in his office and advised me that you know, careers are not ordinarily broken over, made or broken over minor administrative matters during an inspection, and that probably was not a desirable way to go, and kind of chewed my butt. And but fortunately, he saw it as a minor administrative matter and let me go with a verbal reprimand, and didn't give me an Article 15, which for an officer is absolutely the kiss of death. I mean, you cannot survive an Article 15. Right. And sent me on my way. So, and I learned something from that. And when I commanded, I talked about integrity, and I tried to maintain my integrity as well. So.
That's interesting. Did this kind of letter-writing legacy of Mili, did it continue through the 70s?
No, it went for a while and then kind of died out. And, you know, one of the things was when they wrote those letters, they might get a letter back from the congressman saying that it has been investigated and action has been taken, but there was not a whole lot of feedback. You know, they didn't get a letter saying, well, this captain had been flayed and boiled in oil, and so there wasn't a lot of feedback, so it kind of died out. Things did happen, but they were private things and they weren't reported. Right. So.
The guy who wrote you up, or you wrote the letter, did he ever, he didn't find out what happened to you?
I doubt it.
Okay.
I sincerely doubt it.
Returning to kind of some general questions about Vietnam, a lot of books have been written about the war, lots of books. And you still, though, go into a bookstore and it occupies just a few shelves, not like World War One or World War Two or other more popular wars. But tell me your thoughts about, if you have any, about this, your experiences with books you've read on Vietnam, or if you haven't, why you have not read. Comment on what's been written.
Well, I read Fire in the Lake, and most of the books, and that's really about the only one that I can remember right off the top of my head. Reading those books kind of made me uncomfortable. I love reading World War II history, maybe because I'm a little more disassociated from it, I'm a lot more disassociated from it. But reading the Vietnam books really kind of made me uncomfortable.
Do you know why?
Maybe because the perspective was always that, you know, the United States screwed it up and should have done much better, which I can't disagree with, but which I don't necessarily want to see rehashed over and over and over again. So I have not done a lot of reading about it. I love to read. I read a lot, but it's just not something that I was comfortable reading. And so I kind of tended to stay away from it.
That's continued?
That has basically continued. I've been carrying this book around by some guy named Varun, but I have not started that one either. And I've got it, and I look at it every day, but I just have not picked it up and started reading it. And I'm not sure I can really tell you why. Like I said, it just... A sense of unease, a sense of discomfort as I read these. It just reminds me of the media coverage that was so negative for so many years that it's just not something I'm comfortable with. And I think the movies that came out about Vietnam until just recently here kind of exacerbate that feeling situation.
Tell me about seeing movies on Vietnam. Did you see them? Did you not see them? Why? Did you avoid this entirely?
I did see them. I saw Platoon. I saw Napalm in the Morning.
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now. I thought they were both ridiculous movies.
Why?
I'm not going to say those events did not happen. I think they did happen. I mean, the war-related ones, not the stupid ones, but they just carried it to such a tremendous extreme. They just to a ridiculous extreme. And unfortunately, a lot of people who had not had that experience didn't realize that it was being carried to an extreme and kind of took it as reality, when in fact it definitely was not. Mm-hmm. Not reality. The one that came out recently, We Were Soldiers Once. You know, I saw that movie, and at our next staff meeting, we've got a bunch of relatively younger people, 30s and 40s, and I told them, if you really want to see a movie about what it was really like in Vietnam, go see We Were Soldiers Once.
Why did you tell them that?
Because I think that's a much more accurate perception. A much more accurate portrayal of what went on in Vietnam and the way things were. The battalion commander refusing to go back and brief Westmoreland because he was not going to leave his troops in the field. And now this, the earlier days of the war. And the sergeant major, I knew a guy like him. Grinda, Sergeant Major Grinda. And, mm-hmm. Based on my experiences, that was a much more realistic portrayal of the way things went. And certainly it exaggerated some points as well. Mm-hmm. But in the other direction, but not nearly to the extreme that Platoon and Apocalypse Now and those kind of movies, mm-hmm. Those kind of movies did.
Obviously, movies made on subjects that affect the historical memory of the United States population. What do you think about the Rambos, a Vietnam veteran who's holed up in the mountains and misunderstood and hunted, and then comes back to guerrilla warfare to defend himself? What do you think about these kind of things about the stereotypes of the Vietnam veteran?
Well, I think they're silly. And Rambo's not any different than the homeless guy, drug addict, mm-hmm. who commits a crime. They're both victims. Mm-hmm. And they're both portrayed as victims, who were just because of their Vietnam service, just horribly damaged and can't do anything. Mm-hmm. And it's just ridiculous. People suffer from PTSD. It's a very real thing. But very few of them become homeless drug addicts or actually become engaged in guerrilla warfare against police. It's actually a fairly small minority, and those are the ones that get the coverage. And
what have been your experiences with Vietnam veterans? How would you describe Vietnam veterans that you witnessed, that you've seen?
Pretty much normal guys. Most of the Vietnam veterans I've been around were career military, obviously, and maybe might be a little bit better equipped to deal with it pre and post service, since that's kind of what we train to do. Mm-hmm. But pretty much ordinary, normal guys. I never knew a single guy who became a mass murderer because he was in Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about, overall, for the United States, what lessons do you think our country took away from that experience in Southeast Asia?
I think the guy that best personifies that is Colin Powell in the Powell Doctrine. Mm-hmm. Powell is just a brilliant man and an amazing leader. Have a clear mission when you go into a war. What is the mission? How do you define victory? How do you know when you won? have an exit strategy. We never had an exit strategy for Vietnam. The strategy was keep sending more troops. You know, instead of throwing money at it, which in essence we were doing, throw troops at it. And don't do it smart, just overwhelm it with force. And you cannot overcome guerrillas with force. Mm-hmm. And I think we learned some smart things. I think we learned that you cannot, as an army or as a nation, exist in a moral vacuum. And I think that we are paying a price for what happened in the 60s and early 70s. I think we're paying that today in terms of lost time and time out of lives and those kinds of things. But I think the biggest thing as a nation that we've learned is that loss of values, that it wasn't that our values changed, it's that we didn't have any values. We didn't have a compass. We were just kind of wandering, I think, as a nation. And Vietnam was a symptom of that. But what was going on in Haight-Ashbury and a lot of other places was also a symptom of that. It certainly wasn't the whole country. I don't think it was even a majority of the country, but it was a lot of people. And even the people that weren't doing it were certainly affected by it. Things that were not accepted, not the norm a few years before, became acceptable or at least tolerated. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe the biggest thing we've learned is that, you know, we cannot survive like that. You see a lot of talk about values today, and a lot of it's political BS, but a lot of it, I think, is very valid. What are our values? Mm-hmm. And the Army had a big program for a long time about values. You know, what are the Army's values? And how do we inculcate those values? I was a battalion commander at the time. How do we inculcate those values in our subordinates and that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very valid question and a very valid concern. And I think maybe that's one of the things that came out of Vietnam. And I mentioned before this idea of dealing with the soldiers who fight the war differently than people who make the policy. I think that's a very valid lesson, and probably the one I'm happiest to see come mm-hmm. about personally. Mm-hmm.
Do you think Vietnam is still with us today, as far as a government and country?
Oh, very much so. And I think just the frequent comparisons between Vietnam and Iraq show that it's clearly still with us. We're, I think, trying very hard not to make the same kinds of mistakes in Iraq that we made in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent we're succeeding. Mm-hmm. I believe that Iraq will have its own government. I think it's very favorable that their government is asking us to leave as soon as we can, rather than asking us to stay and prop them up for years and years. I don't know what's going to happen when we do leave, but I think it's a favorable sign for the United States and the way we're dealing with Iraq as opposed to the way we dealt with Vietnam, mm-hmm. which was to make them very dependent on us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Today's leaders, military leaders, do you think that they get it when it comes to fighting wars around the world? And when I say get it, I mean as far as strategy. Can they differentiate between a guerrilla type action like the VC were waging against the Americans versus a full conventional war such as we saw a Desert Storm with some guerrilla elements thrown in? I mean, do you think that they have learned, military officers, the general officers who make these large decisions?
Well, you know, I'm so out of touch that it's really, that's a difficult judgment for me to make. I, uh,
I watch with interest the friction between Rumsfeld and the senior military officers, where the military wants the heavy weapons, the new artillery, new state-of-the-art fighter aircraft, those kinds of things, kind of to the exclusion of much else. At least that's what I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that that's necessarily the way to go. Of course, now the word is that the next big adversary will be the Chinese, and that certainly wouldn't be a guerrilla war. So maybe they're on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about before the resistance to the light division concept,
mm-hmm.
and that some general officers actually retired because with you know, strong encouragement, because they were not able to accept and support that concept.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe we do have a little bit too much of a heavy armor mindset. There certainly is a place for heavy forces, and I think they're essential, and we have to keep heavy forces. Desert Storm and the Chinese, I think, clearly show that.
Yes.
But there's also has to be space for lighter forces. Trying to use tanks to do what we're doing in Iraq, much of it just doesn't work. We started off with a huge advantage in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
by deposing Saddam. You know, we made so many friends in Iraq that we started off with a huge advantage. And even though we're dealing with such a different culture, with the Islamic culture that in many ways is so insular,
mm-hmm.
That it's very difficult. I think we have done much better there than we did in Vietnam. And I think largely that's because of a lot of the things that we learned in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The senior leadership of the Army today are very bright, very intelligent, articulate guys who have a clear vision of where they want to take the Army. And I guess the question is does that vision coincide with reality? And I think to a large extent it does.
Right. So the lessons have been incorporated.
I really think so. I really think that as a nation and as a military, we've learned those lessons to a very large extent. And I think we're acting on those lessons. And, clearly when Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, we had learned those lessons. And, everybody knew the Powell Doctrine. And, the Schwarzkopf's, who was a guy I'm glad I didn't work for.
How do you say that?
He's a tough guy to work for. Man, he's hard.
Yeah.
And he'll burn staff officers out just by working them so hard. And you only get one mistake. And he's a tough guy to work for.
Mm-hmm.
And he can be tough because he's so damn good. And when you are going to command in the Army, you go to a school called the Crew Command Course.
Mm-hmm.
And Schwarzkopf was a division commander at that time, and he came and gave us a speech.
Mm-hmm.
And he was probably the best speaker I've ever heard.
Really?
Yeah. A friend of mine was a battalion XO in the 24th when he commanded. And he said that Schwarzkopf, as a two-star, had a sunrise division formation. Had the whole division out there, and we're
wow.
talking 20,000 guys.
Wow.
With all their equipment, tanks and PCs and all of that kind of stuff. He gave them a speech, sunrise.
Every day?
No, just one special occasion. And old Jim Askew told me that by the time Schwarzkopf was done speaking, he said, these guys were jumping up and down and foaming at the mouth. They just wanted to go kill something. He was such a charismatic leader and speaker that he could just, get people fired up.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And and of course, they're both retired now, but just
typical, I think, of mm-hmm. the kind of leaders that we have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the Army, the system works. You know, the cream rises to the top. I mean, the guys who are good and who are smart and who know how to manage their careers, you know, they rise to the top. Mm-hmm. And you don't get to be a general in the Army by being a dummy. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a lot of respect for anybody who makes general officer.
Okay. How do you think the United States government's treated its people and veterans?
Until recently, pretty poorly.
What have you seen?
I'll give you an personal example. You used to have a thing called dual compensation. I'm 50% disabled. Mm-hmm. And that was determined by the Veterans Administration when I retired. So I got veterans disability pay to compensate me for that. Mm-hmm. My military retired pay was reduced dollar for dollar by the amount of my veterans disability compensation. My net benefit for being 50% disabled due to my military service, as determined by the VA, was the tax benefit, because VA compensation is non-taxable, whereas retirement pay is taxable. Mm-hmm. Now, that when I mentioned that the government has treated us quite well lately, mm-hmm. that's one of the things they've changed. They're phasing in over 10 years. Dual compensation is no longer around. They're phasing in over 10 years where you will be able to get both. So every year I get a little bit more retired pay,
right,
until we come up to the amount that had been deducted. I still don't get it all.
It's a lot of money lost.
It is a lot of money lost. And so that's, I think that was...
It's a good example.
That was kind of poor.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of an example of how things went.
Tell me about your opinion of Vietnam today, the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. Do you have a desire to go back? And
you know, I really don't. I just have no desire. I read about the guys. I watch the TV documentaries about the guys that go back, and I guess I understand that. And if you were to offer me a trip today, I'd take it. Mm-hmm. But more out of idle curiosity than anything else. I just don't really have any big emotional attachment to the country mm-hmm. of Vietnam as it is today. You know, the Vietnam that I knew is gone. I have no love for the current government of Vietnam. When I look at John McCain, I remember. And I don't like what they did. And I don't like them because they did it. And, yeah, they can dislike me because I fought them in a war, but I never tortured their... Me personally, I never tortured their people as a government policy. You know, obviously we tortured Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese that we captured. I think that's pretty common knowledge, but it wasn't government policy.
Right.
And that was their government policy. So, no, I don't have any desire to go back at all.
You don't want to see Tay Nan or Quang Le any of that?
I'd be very surprised if any fragment of what I knew there is still there. So, no, I just don't have any desire to go back. You know, like we were talking about before, it's not one of the most significant events in my life. And obviously, it's an important event, or I wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't have any desire to go back.
Okay.
I'm not curious about that.
Okay. When you finished with the Illinois National Guard, you're embedded now in your career. This mm-hmm. is, you have decided this is your life. This is going to be your formal career.
By now I've got enough time in where I'm past that point of no return that in terms of retirement benefits.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't retire in reasonable, I couldn't leave the Army and reasonably expect to make up the benefits I'd already earned.
Right.
So financially, it was not a good decision. And personally, I really liked the Army. I was having a good time. I was enjoying what I was doing. And I was enjoying the moving around and seeing different places. I got orders for Europe, and I really wanted to go to Europe.
That was right after Illinois? That
right
was,
after Illinois, yeah.
How did you get that?
It just came up my turn. I had called my assignments officer at branch and told him, hey, you know, when I'm done here, I'd like to go to Europe. And, you know, and when they can, when they reasonably can, they'll meet your desires. Mm-hmm. You know, the buzzword is the needs of the Army. But, you know, they needed a logistics officer, a logistics captain in Germany, and I wanted to go, so they sent me.
And how long were you there in Germany?
4 years.
What was that like?
Oh, it was great. It was great. That was the assignment that made my career.
In what way?
In terms of my performance appraisals, not OERs.
What years are this?
This was 77 to 81. And I went over there, and I was, as a logistics officer, I went to Frankfurt, was assigned to the Material Management Center for 5th Corps, in the support command there, third support command. And RCG was a one-star. I worked for a couple of very fine lieutenant colonels. Jerry Lindsay was just a great guy. And Bill Foy, I didn't call him that at the time. I called him by their first name, sir. And but great guys, good leaders, good logisticians, good managers. And Colonel Lindsay, when I got there, I was an ordnance officer, and he put me in a supply position. And I said, yes, sir. And I didn't speak the language or anything. But I learned pretty quickly. And I had some good NCOs that were real patient with me and taught me the system. And I'm just one of those people. I understand how pieces of a system fit together. I can just see that. There's other things I don't do well, but I can see that. And so I was able to understand the logistics system.
Right.
And we were kind of at the halfway point between the wholesale system and the retail system.
Right.
And so I did very well. Did very well there. And it was really kind of ideal. I mean, we didn't work real late a lot of times. We didn't work a lot of weekends. So I had a lot of family time, and we traveled a lot, saw a lot. Went to France several times. Went to England. Went to Wales. So we got to travel. Learned a lot. Real learning experience on the technical side of it. And that's where I got into automation. The Army was automating very heavily. And I was having a discussion with one of our IT guys, and I knew nothing about it at the time. And we had about an hour-long argument before we discovered we were violently agreeing. We were both saying the same thing. I was talking logistics, he was talking IT, and neither one of us understood the other one. So I figured, okay, to survive, I am going to have to learn IT. And so I started getting into it. And found out I was pretty good at it. I could see pieces of the system. I'm probably one of the few guys around that you're going to talk to that knows what a 360-50 is, which is one of the first big IBM mainframes.
Tell me about that. How did you work with 360-50?
Well, the Army had its own dedicated IT support. The 3rd Support Command had a big section that was computer support. Was all mounted in vans so we could take it to the field, God forbid. And at that time, everything was Big Blue. Everything was IBM.
Right.
And we had all IBM hardware. The 360-50 was a real breakthrough in information technology.
Why?
Because it was kind of a modular system. You could get a 360-20. You could get a 360-30. You could get a 360-70. You could add components on to make it as big or as small as you wanted, without having to have, big or small means as powerful or not as you want it,
right,
without having to have one specific mainframe that couldn't be upgraded except at very great expense. And so it was a real breakthrough in the marketplace, and really gave IBM dominance worldwide. And they were all blue, which is why you called it Big Blue. And that was, they had a couple of 360/50s with the, and that was our main computer support.
How large was it physically?
Oh, it was huge. It was probably 5 feet long by 3 feet wide by 4 feet high, and had maybe 1% of the capacity that your desktop does, mm-hmm. maybe 1%.
Mm-hmm. But you're right there on the early stages of computers.
This was cutting edge. I mean, I'll tell you how far back this goes, was we had punch cards, we had card readers, interpreters, the whole works. In fact, one of our guys once went and picked up a pallet load of punch cards and left it out in the rain. Well, when punch cards get, especially when they get wet, but even when they get damp, mm-hmm. they swell just a little bit. And when they hit that high-speed card reader, they don't go through. Mm-hmm. And you wind up with cards all over the place because they hit jam and spew cards mm-hmm. all over. Well, that's data. That's information you're losing there. Especially since usually the operator, what he'll do to avoid another jam is reach in that deck of data cards and take out about that many mm-hmm. and just throw them away so you don't jam his machine.
And you're holding your hand, your fingers about an inch.
Oh, about an inch apart. Okay. And he'll just throw those in the trash can so you don't jam his machine. Well, that might be a requisition for a tank engine right. or a rifle or right. anything. Now it's gone. And so it was pretty interesting. I really enjoyed it. And we were linked to the system at headquarters, United States Army Europe, USER. And they were linked to the States. And while I was there, we changed, so we had a direct link to the system in the States and that kind of stuff. And it did very well, and my name got known a little bit. And
because of your work with logistics
yes.
and computers?
With or logistics,
okay.
yeah. Well, and my understanding of the automation side of it helped me do my job much, much better.
Right.
And so I was able to get another desirable job. I was selected for promotion to major, the only one in my in the MMC that was. And, you know, it seemed like I had been a captain for 100 years. But during Vietnam, you spent 12 months as a second lieutenant, made first, and it was basically
right.
automatic.
Right.
You spent 12 months as a first lieutenant, made captain.
Right.
Well, then you were a captain. The war ended.
Right.
The need for majors dropped off drastically. They went a couple of years, didn't even have a promotion selection board. So you waited. And
so how long did you wait?
Golly, I made captain in 69, and I made major in 78, 9 years.
Wow.
8.5 years.
Wow.
And
did you leave Germany when you made major?
No, I stayed in the same job. I was in a major's position. It's very common to be in a position, as an officer, to be in a position one grade senior. Mm-hmm. I was in a major's job, so I just... Now I was getting paid for the job I had.
And, isn't that nice how that works?
Yeah. And, well, you know, the Army's smart. They get a hard-charging young captain and put him in a major's position. And
knowing that you want to get that pay grade.
Absolutely.
And that promotion off.
Yeah. And, well, you know, it looks good. I'm filling a major's position.
Sure.
But anyway, there are certain positions, jobs that you want to get if you want to get promoted. And... and get selected for more good jobs in the future, and so I was able to get on as a maintenance operations officer in one of our maintenance battalions, the 8th Maintenance Battalion. I worked for a guy named Colonel Sidlow, good guy, and then our battalion executive officer left, and I asked him what became the battalion executive officer. Did very well in both positions, and felt like I did a good job. I sure worked hard, and had a good staff. Just had some real good warrant officers and NCOs, young captains working for me, and I could call them young captains because man, I had been an old captain, and did very well in terms of performance appraisals. And came back to the States and went to the Logistics Executive Development Course and kind of had to yell and holler to get selected for that. All of, or most of my assignments, most of my experience had been at what we call the retail level, the lower levels.
Right.
And this was a school for the wholesale level.
Right.
It was totally oriented on the wholesale level. And I needed to know the wholesale level. And I knew a little bit just from dealing with them.
Sure.
But I needed to know a lot more about it. And so I was selected for that school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a six-month course. I did well. I was on the commandant's list.
Where was this?
This was at Fort Lee, Virginia.
Okay. So you're officially transferred back over?
Officially, I came back from Germany in 81.
Mm-hmm.
We spent 2 years in Frankfurt. And then we spent 2 years at a small town outside of Frankfurt called Hanau. Mm-hmm. And on Rosalheim Kaserne. But we came back, went to Fort Lee, Virginia to go to this school. Spent 6 months there. Very interesting school.
Mm-hmm.
And big block on IT. I did very well on that one. Since I was teaching it in junior college at the time. And anyway, then I stayed at Fort Lee.
Mm-hmm.
We were living on post. Had a nice little set of quarters, but I stayed at Fort Lee and went to the United States Army Logistics Center.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned several times how I was fortunate, and luck struck again. What the logistics center did was design logistics systems for the Army. Both the automated kind and just the system as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
It had become kind of a backwater.
What do you mean?
It was kind of an undesirable assignment. It had kind of stagnated. Was not known for producing a lot of good stuff. And for making a lot of breakthroughs that were accepted Army-wide, it was just kind of there, not just kind of idling along, if
right.
you will.
This is Fort Lee as well?
At Fort Lee, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, after LEDAC, the Logistics Executive Development Course, we stayed on at Fort Lee and went to the Ball Center. I got there. And I went in, I was assigned as a military, I was still in the military, assigned as a systems analyst.
Okay.
On automated logistics systems. And the Army had been working on an automated maintenance management system for years and years. It never managed to get it out to the field.
Right.
And so I was working on this. And I didn't realize that it really was kind of an undesirable assignment. Well, the Army looked at the log center and said, we need to do something. And they took probably the most hard-charging logistics three-star in the Army at that time. And I cannot remember his name. God, I should remember it. But anyway, and put him down there to revitalize the logistics center. Made it a very high priority assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to handpick his key staff and bring in any officer that he wanted and
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing. And he got there, and the first thing he did was clean house. A whole lot of guys came to work one morning to find out they were being reassigned out of the log center.
Were you there, already there? When he
already
was
there
in?
When he came in.
Hmm.
And and so, I mean, there was a guy you were sitting there working with one day. The next day, there was an empty desk, literally, as they were reassigned out somewhere. And he couldn't do that with the civilians, but he certainly tried, and a bunch of them left. He really cleaned house and brought in a bunch of new guys.
Why were you allowed to stay?
I guess the guys they thought were doing well enough, you know, were meeting the standards or had some potential, were allowed to stay. He didn't get rid of everybody.
Right.
Just those whose supervisors identified as not up to snuff, not up to par.
You're still getting good OERs.
I don't, haven't had one yet. I've got a very good academic OER. They're not worth much, but for what it was worth, it was good. And I hadn't really had one yet. And I got sent off on a couple of special studies and that kind of stuff. But anyway, he came in, like I say, cleaned house, completely restructured the thing, and brought in his own guys, his key staff. Well, the guys in our office were concerned that our system, which was SAMS, was the name of it, was kind of dying on the vine. Mm-hmm. We were really afraid that it was going to get canceled. We thought it was going to be a good thing for the Army. And we thought the Army was going to say, you know, you guys have been working on this for 12 years, and it's not going to the it's not out to the field yet, and so you need to, we're just going to cancel it. And what we did was put together a briefing, and that we were going to give to key people to try and raise the visibility and try to get some more resources and mm-hmm. kind of get our system moving forward and revitalized.
Right.
And one of the guys that came in when the new general did was Wild Bill Flynn. And
this is another one of your lucky
stories
about how this worked out.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about dumb luck. First of all, I was there when the new general came in and was going to revitalize the place.
Right.
You know, the chief staff made this decision, raised the priority, became a very high priority assignment for logistics officers. Mm-hmm. That was number one. Number two was one of the guys that we gave this briefing to was Bill Flynn. And or sir, and at that time Colonel Flynn, and he was a New Englander, very outgoing, charismatic, extroverted kind of guy. Mm-hmm. Just his favorite saying was "up yours." He said that to everybody, So anyway, he was one of the guys, is one of the deputy commanders at the log center that we briefed. Mm-hmm. Well, they had cleaned out one of the departments upstairs in this two-story building, another department, and he remembered me from this briefing and reached out and touched me and was going to put me in this job upstairs. And I really didn't want to go. It was in concepts and doctrine. Mm-hmm. And which is pretty much what you thought, mm-hmm. logistics concepts and then developing logistics doctrine. Mm-hmm. So I went and talked to my boss, who was a four colonel, and he said that he had talked to the chief of staff about it, and the chief of staff had asked him, is Curry worth your career? In other words, if he was going to fight to keep me in there, it was right. going to cost him. And wow. he allowed us how I wasn't worth his career, and I agreed with him. So off to concepts and doctrine I went and worked for Bill Flynn. And the guy I replaced had been the head of the section up there that was developing the high technology test bed mm-hmm. in the 9th Infantry Division out of Fort Lewis, Washington. Mm-hmm. It was the high technology test site, and we had the HTTB, high technology test bed, or as one guy liked to say, here, try this bullshit. But anyway, they would test new equipment, they would test new logistics concepts, that kind of thing.
So you got to see all of this.
So I got to see all of this. Got a new chief of staff. We just kind of got this office up and rolling, and at this point I was basically bypassing my boss, who was another full colonel, and going directly to Flynn. Because Flynn would just call you directly. He wouldn't go to your boss. He'd call you directly and say, do this.
That puts you in a difficult position.
Very difficult. Had a great guy who really understood what Flynn was doing and never gave me a bit of grief about it.
Why was his nickname Wild Bill? Because of his...
Because of his personality. Okay. He was just so out for it. He'd work you to death. But new chief of staff came up with the light division, and we were tasked to develop the logistics doctrine for the light division, do the force development on the logistics side.
Explain what the light division concept was.
The light division was is a very mobile force. The idea is that you would be able to get the division in on the ground, combat ready in 96 hours or so, as opposed to the weeks it takes to move a division with tanks and heavy artillery and armored personnel carriers and those kinds of things. Like when we went to Desert Storm, I was at 3 Corps, we'd take all our stuff down to Houston, put it on the ships, and they would sail it over to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait.
Right.
That took weeks.
Right.
But the idea here was you load a whole bunch of guys in their very light equipment, mm-hmm. like a company would have one truck. That's it. And they could be on the ground combat ready in a matter of hours.
Why were people so opposed to this? Because it was it too scary for them? They thought it wouldn't meet Cold War expectations?
Well, it was very scary. You know, there's an old cliche that says we're always fighting the last war. And in this case, the last war but one. We weren't mm-hmm. still fighting Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But the Army was based on heavy divisions. Mechanized infantry and armor divisions, and the only difference is a slightly different mix of mech infantry and armor battalions. Mm-hmm. And that was all the doctrine was written around that. Mm-hmm. The combat tactics were based on that. I mean, we were going to fight the Soviet Union.
Right.
That's all there was to it.
They're going to come pouring through the Fulda Gap
exactly.
And you're going to have it out conventional warfare.
And we had to have enough tanks and artillery to fight the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. The chief of staff, the chief said no. You know, he came up with a spectrum of intensity of warfare and probability.
A spectrum of intensity?
Spectrum of intensity that ranged from a guerrilla war on one end. Maybe in Central America was the hotspot at that time, up the spectrum to all-out nuclear war at the top end of the spectrum. So you went from low-intensity conflict, or LIC, to high-intensity conflict. Mm-hmm. And he assigned probabilities to the conflict based on intensity.
Who was this person's name? Do you remember?
He was the chief of staff of the Army. We called him the chief. I should remember his name, but I sure don't. Probably find it. But
what year was this?
This was 84.
Okay.
And his analysis found that a low-intensity conflict, a guerrilla-type war, against lightly armed forces was going to be much, much more probable than a high-intensity exchange with the Soviet Union.
And based on basically the MAD scenario, mutually assured destruction.
Exactly.
Not going to go there, but if something happens, it'd probably be down the scale.
Yes. And we were probably going to be fighting guerrilla forces, indigenous guerrilla forces. Mm-hmm. And like I say, it was based on Central America was kind of
right.
the scenario at that time. Honduras, Nicaragua, those places. Mm-hmm. And what he said was, we have no force structure in place to meet this kind of threat. We have nobody trained to meet this kind of threat. If that happens, we're going to be in Vietnam all over again, trying to fight a peasant with an AK-47 with an M1 tank.
Right.
Which is great if you can find him.
Right.
But since he can hear you coming from 3 miles away and you can't hear him at all, the probability of finding him is not very great. He also found that the earlier you can get military force on the ground and intervene mm-hmm. in a guerrilla-type war, the better your chances of rapid success are. Mm-hmm. And it just seems intuitive now, but at the time this was all breakthrough stuff.
Sure.
When all you were thinking about was the Fulda Gap.
Right. Was there someone on the kind of civilian, or not civilian, but the more cultural side saying, we can develop this light division concept and have the military arm ready, but we also need to understand the society into which we would put this light division?
Well, we've always had civil affairs units. But that, we figured that was mostly State Department business.
They take care of that.
That was their job. Okay. You know, our job was the military force side.
Okay. Was there any interaction, communication between the two?
There was at the higher levels,
okay.
But not down at my level. And I was a major as a staff officer. And,
Right.
So, you know, they didn't consult me on those things.
Right.
Okay. And that became the number one priority in the Army, was developing this night division force structure.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the 9th Infantry at Fort Lewis,
mm-hmm.
and we had a division at Fort Ord. And I'm trying to remember which division that was at the time, but I don't remember. But anyway, God, this was a long time ago. But anyway, mm-hmm. so we just, I mean, we crashed and burned. 18-hour days were not unusual at all.
Doing what?
Trying to get this force structure pulled together.
And how to supply it and get it to where it needs to be.
Exactly.
In well, 96 hours.
Exactly. And what we had to do was find out from the combat arms guys, and they had the combined arms center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. They were doing the combat arms side of this. Mm-hmm. We were the logistics center. We and our component schools, which were all the logistics schools, were doing the logistics side of it. What we had to do was find out, okay, what's the combat arms doctrine? What are their plans? And then how do we support that? And you know, how do we get what forces and what materials do we need
mm-hmm.
to support the combat arms guys when?
Could you make requests of any piece of equipment? We need these kind of transport planes. We need, they say they need this many trucks. So we need to get these trucks that fit on these planes. I mean, was that what you were doing, or was it?
They gave us a set of parameters. The chief staff, his office gave us a set of parameters. It had to be 100% mobile and C-5A aircraft, which of course is a big mama,
mm-hmm.
and we had to be able to put. They gave us a time phasing. We had to be able to put forces on the ground in 24 hours, 48, 96, et cetera, and be fully deployed in X number of hours.
Right.
Using C-5A aircraft.
And this is coming from the United States.
This is coming from the United States.
Yes, assuming that the base would be here, you'd be moving this light division from the U.S., or from Fort Ord, or from
Fort Lewis,
to the hotspot.
Exactly. You know, maybe it's Honduras. So we would have to, and we worked with the Air Force, they would have to bring in C-5As and craft, the Civilian Reserve Air Fleet, bring those aircraft in, pick up the equipment, and move it to wherever the hotspot was within this number of hours.
But were they considering basing on light divisions somewhere in the world? Because, you know, it would just help you out logistically so much to have one of the light divisions, say, in Germany, or have one of the light divisions in Turkey.
Not at that time.
Okay.
No, there was really no discussion of that, and there are still are no light divisions overseas. We have one now at Fort Drum, the 10th Mountain.
Okay.
And I think, I say, I'm kind of really out of touch. I think the 25th in Hawaii is also a light division.
I know the 10th Mountain's actually in Afghanistan.
Yes.
There.
In fact, Mike Ellicott, my boss, mm-hmm. his son is an Engineer Corps major, and he's getting ready to go to Afghanistan.
How did Pat Curry take this concept then? Did you say, oh my God, this is ridiculous, or wow, let's hit it, let's see what happens?
I thought, man, this makes so much sense. You could read what was going on in the paper. Guerrillas were doing
right.
this. Guerrillas were doing that. I mean, you could just see it in the newspaper. And I just thought, man, this makes so much sense. Nobody ever proposed getting rid of all the heavy divisions. That was never a thought.
Right. This is in addition to.
And you know, the patron saint of the Army, Ronald Reagan, was giving us the resources we needed to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to ask you how you thought Reagan treated the military and how his vision fit into this new concept of the light division.
If you ask me who has made the biggest impact on the United States and on history in the last 100 years, Reagan would be very close to the top of my list. I mean, let's face it, he won the Cold War. The man won the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
He's a personal hero.
Mm-hmm.
when he was given his State of the Union speech and had that buck sergeant there, Sergeant E5, sitting there in uniform in the audience. I mean, my eyes were wet. That was just an amazing thing to do. And if you look at the guy who brought soldiers back and who brought the Army back, it's Ronald Reagan.
How do you feel about his comment about Vietnam, that it was a worthy cause?
Oh, I agree with him.
That he is credited for kind of closing the chapter on the Vietnam War. And the war part, Clinton is the one who came in and normalized relations after, you know, people had built some framework for him to do that. But Reagan is credited by many historians. You know, he's the guy who kind of closed the coffin, if you will, but in a positive light.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's true. He made being a soldier a respectable profession again, and then gave us the resources to rebuild the Army.
Was what you just said become, he made the soldier respectable again from the Vietnam experience?
Yeah.
Rehabilitated.
And the aftermath.
Right, the decline of the quality.
The military, yeah. He rehabilitated the image. But more importantly, he rehabilitated the Army. You know, I mean, look at the budgets we had been getting. You know, people ask me about Jimmy Carter, and I just spit on the ground, you know. Mm-hmm. When I was in Germany, we had to turn off our coffee pots at 9 o'clock in the morning because we didn't have money to pay our utility bills. My wife had no hot water to wash our clothes in. This was in government quarters now.
And you obviously have requested hot water.
But they turned it off. They turned off hot water in all the barracks. I mean, in barracks. Well, in the barracks too, but in the laundry rooms of all the government quarters. They would not turn the heat on in the buildings until it had been below 60 degrees for 3 consecutive days. And we had 2 small kids. Those kinds of things. We did not have enough fuel to take the unit to the field to train.
This is because of the Carter administration
budget cuts. After post-Vietnam. It wasn't all the Carter administration, but I saw it firsthand in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Had the Soviets come through at that time, we'd have been in real trouble.
Why didn't they?
I'm not sure they were any more capable of it than we were, to be honest. They had their own problems. You know, we tend to see them as this monolithic block of super soldiers, and they weren't.
Yeah, you're talking 13, 14 years later, they're gone.
They're gone. They had a lot of maintenance problems, a lot of equipment problems, that kind of thing. And I think they knew that our only option would have been to use nuclear weapons, and they weren't ready to pull that trigger. And we would have had to. We would have had to use nuclear weapons because we couldn't have survived otherwise.
So when Reagan came in, everything started to turn around.
Oh, man, did it ever. I mean, you know, there was so much excitement in the Army about Reagan coming in. And I was still in Germany when mm-hmm. he came in. Mm-hmm. But there was so much excitement in the Army about him coming in. And you could just see the impact almost immediately. Our facilities were so run down and beat up, and we started getting money to... I mean, our guys, they had to wear gloves while they were working in the shops because we had no heat in the shops, and we had no money to put heat in.
It's incredible.
It was sad.
Difficult.
It's just sad.
I imagine it's very difficult to command in situations
like that. Oh, very. I mean, how do you train your guys if you can't take them to the field? We'd save up fuel. But, I mean, I'll tell you how bad it was. We get fuel cuts. And as a battalion executive officer, as a field grade officer, I would have to approve the dispatch of a vehicle off post. Because, you know, on a run of some kind. Because
mm-hmm.
we just didn't have the fuel. And I would make them get together and consolidate runs and that kind of thing.
Wow.
To save fuel, because we just didn't have any money to buy fuel. Well, Carter, Secretary of the Army, people were saying, you know, the Army's really underpaid. And it wasn't as bad as when I first came in before Mendel Rivers came along. But but it was still pretty bad. And he was, and the Secretary of the Army said, if they don't like it, they can vote with their feet. Let them vote with their feet. And of course, the good guys did.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a pretty telling statement about the Carter administration's attitude towards the military. But anyway, Reagan came in, and like I said, you could just see the difference in attitude immediately, and in resources very, very quickly. So we had a lot of support, a lot of funding, and so it was a good time to be working on this. So we had the support from the National Command Authority, which is the president. We had the support from the National Command Authority to do this kind of innovative force development.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the funding to do it with.
And you obviously succeeded with it.
Yes. And it was not easy. It was a little bit like giving birth to a bathtub. I mean, we were at one point, in order to meet the combat arms requirements, the Division Support Command, which is the logistics element in a division, had to be the first troops on the ground. bad idea.
Right.
Bad idea.
Right.
And so we were able to fix that, and we did the medical support structure, we did the maintenance and supply, we did all that kind of stuff.
So you were one of those who were actually sitting down and coming up with how this would happen.
Exactly. We would just sit down and say, okay, we do not have space for 8 mechanics. We have space for 3 mechanics. So we take 5 and take them out. And we can't move 3 trucks. You get 1. And we came up with some really new concepts. We essentially eliminated the retail level. You know, if they needed a rifle, we wouldn't repair it. We'd give them a new one. You know, we'd just give them a new one.
And
so we didn't have to carry repair parts.
Right. Kind of older one would come back to the States.
Exactly.
You repair it there and then
put back in the
plug
system.
Back into the system.
Yeah, exactly.
Was this fun?
It was so hard, so much hard work, but it was fun. You could really see what you were doing. You know, you looked at the Chief of Staff of the Army's map for the Army and you thought, man, I'm participating here. I'm helping. And old Flynn just worked our butts off. Oh my God, I'll never forget at the office Christmas party. Everybody was off partying for Christmas, and I was working my butt off.
Were you really?
I really was.
And Diana's opinion of this?
Not high.
Yeah.
But actually, Diana was. You know, if you look up perfect Army wife in the dictionary, there's Diana's picture. She never gave me a hard time about working long hours. She never gave me a hard time about going to the field and being gone for weeks on end. She just understood and she took care of things. I mean, just, you know, soldier on. And I don't remember Diana ever saying, you know, if you don't come home at 5 o'clock, I'm leaving. Or, you know, I want you to come home at 5 o'clock, I'm mad. Or I just mm-hmm. don't remember her. I remember her bringing me clean uniforms when I had to work all night. Never anything but maximum support from Diana. And not all the wives were like that. But I knew more than a few good guys who got out because their wife couldn't handle it. But
how's it?
She didn't like the long hours, but
right.
She didn't complain either.
How's it feel now, looking back, that you're right there at kind of ground zero with this very, very interesting concept, new concept, and it's still today, and it's successful.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. See, this was one of the first times in my career, actually the first time in my career, when I'd been able to see the big picture, the strategic picture, and how it ties to, you know, that mechanic in the field or that supply guy in the field. Before, it had always been an operational kind of job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, long-range planning is this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm in a job where we're talking 5, 10, 15 years out.
Right.
And it really was a cultural change for me and really interesting. And really, the first time I've been able to say, you know, I'm really working on something that's going to impact the entire future of the Army. And it was a good feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And Flynn just took such good care of you.
He worked your butt off, did take care.
He worked your butt off, but he took really good care of you.
Is this, were you still a major? Or
still a major. And I was selected for lieutenant colonel towards the end of my tour.
Okay.
I was still a major.
And this is still at Fort Lee?
Still at Fort Lee.
And how long were you there?
I was there 3 years.
Okay, to 1984.
Yeah.
We need to wrap up for your okay. time frame this morning, but a couple of other quick questions. I guess this is obvious, but now I see how easily you fit into a university kind of strategic planning, looking at the big picture of what a giant university is doing in your current position, where there you just described this hugely important brand new concept, and you grasp this kind of downward looking. I can see the whole tree
mm-hmm.
of logistics
mm-hmm.
for this incredibly, maybe one of the most important functions of a government is to have a functional military that can meet any enemy.
Exactly.
And so you help design this, and then you take that obviously into your civilian life after the Army when you get out in 91, and you can take it to the bank and really use that stuff on a practical level.
Absolutely. It is. It's a real, you know, it's a real practical kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
You know, in some jobs. And, you know, in my current position, we're looking at the future of the university, and there's a lot of parallels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Army, you do periodically, the Department of Defense does a threat analysis.
Right.
What's the threat going to be? And here we do an academic analysis. You know, where do we need to focus our resources in the future? Research and education and those kinds of things. So there's a lot of parallels. The process is very similar between the military and a university or a big business
mm-hmm.
or anything else. You know, I mean, that strategic planning process is kind of the same.
So these 4 years go by, you're successful, obviously. You're promoted to lieutenant colonel, and your next post is going to be where?
Pentagon.
And didn't you say that this was not a very good experience?
It was not a good experience for me.
Okay.
It was interesting. I saw a lot. I learned a lot. I did a lot. I did not fit in well. I was really more operationally oriented. The Pentagon is based to a huge extent on money, as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
I did not adapt well. Worked for a great guy,
mm-hmm.
Colonel Guest, who later made Brigadier General. Worked for a civilian who I did not get along with, named Mary Ellen Harvey. She was an SES, Senior Executive Service, which is a very senior person in the civil service. Very bright, very bright lady.
Mm-hmm.
But we did not, well, we used to call her a tiller the honey. Very bright, very knowledgeable, but boy, hard to work with. And so I didn't do terrible, but I didn't do great either.
Okay.
But fortunately, my background in Germany and the Log Center, Flynn matched me out, gave me a special OER, which means out of cycle. And my boss, the one I said understood, they treated me very, very well. And so I was selected for battalion command.
Okay. Why don't we stop here so we get to the point we can pick up next time.
All right.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.